Is Guy English Kicking Bear Napkin his full Indian name?
Actually, there's a couple of dances with in there, but I skipped it for brevity.
It was Runs with Napkins originally, but, you know, I married into the Kicking Bear family.
Which is very cool.
Yeah, this is already off the rails.
All right, so we're talking about Mavericks. Apple has shipped OS 10.9. Ryan, I'm going to start with you because you had absolutely no responsibility to this OS whatsoever.
That's good to hear. So I can actually talk about this OS. What would you like to know?
Let's just set the stage. What are your quick thoughts on Mavericks as it is today before we jump into where we want it to go?
My quick thoughts. Well, first of all, I'm delighted by the price. Like, the fact that it is free is an absolute game changer, at least as far as I'm concerned as an app developer. Like, it's fantastic that this is finally something that I can roughly go out to most users and say, okay, you know, you're on 10.6, 10.7, 10.8, but there is now a strong path for you to get on the latest OS. Please, please, please upgrade so that I myself can take advantage of that and thus make better apps more efficiently, taking advantage of the newest stuff out there. So that is hands down for me, the most important thing. But like in my day-to-day usage, it's a really good question that you asked because, you know, I went through and kind of preparing for this and reviewed all the stuff that Apple posted on the web about things that were new, and nothing really jumped out at me. But I enjoy using the operating system. Like a lot of the lower, what they call the advanced features, like app napping, timer coalescing, and compressed memory, and all the Safari power saving features, like that actually makes the operating system for me a very enjoyable thing to use. Like I actually really love using Mail in Mavericks because of the smooth scrolling. Like as stupid as it is, that's a small thing, but I can now scroll through my messages and it doesn't jerk and stutter as much as it used to. And I get longer battery life. Things seem to be faster. In general, I'm really happy with the operating system. But nothing, like if no one thing in there right now, like sets the stage and says, this blows me away. This is something I have never had before, and I absolutely need now, which I could say with at least prior operating systems.
My Retina MacBook Pro 2012 went from 3 hours of battery life to 5 hours of battery life 5 minutes after I installed Mavericks.
Wow. Okay, that's incredible.
And I know you were talking quite a lot about the power-saving stuff recently, Guy.
Yeah, I gave a talk in Boston about the power-saving. I mean, so to me, it's interesting when you compare Mavericks to iOS 7. Because iOS 7 is sort of loosening the leash a little bit in terms of what processors can do in the background, while Mavericks is sort of adding these APIs, like you mentioned, the time coalescing, the app nap, those kind of features that sort of allow developers to better understand their usage of power in the system and better manage the consumption of battery. It's opt-in, but it's not really opt-in because if you're running on Mavericks, you're getting stuff like AppNap, but they give you tools to help you improve your performance and better understand where you're, you know, where the energy's going.
I mean, frankly, that's some of the most surprising stuff about this release is these are things that we had discussed and brainstormed when I was back at Apple, at least some of them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were pushed off because they would be disruptive to developers, or they'd require opt-in and we'd have to either force them or go on this huge evangelism operation. Right. And I love the fact that they made an appearance because they are legitimately good things that in at least 99.9% of the applications that are out there will not affect the user's experience with that app at all. But in aggregate, taking across the user's experience with the system lead to a much, much better experience. Like, Renee, 2 hours of battery life. I mean, hell, it used to be you'd have to buy a whole new computer to get that. And now it's just downloading a free operating system and installing that. That's fantastic.
It's miraculous. Thanks. The only thing I had to do was opt Final Cut Pro 10 out of AppNap because otherwise it would never finish rendering.
That's an example of like the small fraction of apps that would be impacted and that users do have to take some action on. Like, that's it is unfortunate that happens, but I think it's good for the overall advancement of the system.
Well, yeah, Final Cut Pro 10 is an Apple app, and so Apple can just call the private APIs to automatically opt it out of out of AppNap.
Well, you want to check your technical private yourself. APIs. Aren't those public APIs?
No, there's private ones that you can call to say whether you're eligible to have now. They could, of course, if they're going to revise the application, they could just do what they told everyone else to do and actually adopt the APIs that do exist and are public to say things like, hey, I'm running a background render job. Don't consider me to be eligible for napping or do power.
Like a million they have a pretty nuanced way of describing what you're actually working on, too, which I thought was pretty cool.
That's always the problem with these type of things is if you just do it with evangelism and say, oh, we got all these great new APIs and developers, you should totally adopt these APIs. Developers are like, if it doesn't result in a feature that lets them sell more copies or have a new version of their app that will please users, they're like, meh, not a big deal. So I that's why I've said a couple times that the energy shaming thing in the battery menu is like the most important feature in the operating system in terms of energy saving, because even the developers who do nothing, all of a sudden they're going to start getting the annoying support emails from the people going, I saw your application up in the menu and my battery didn't seem to last as long. And I think it's because and it totally won't be because of their application. Right. But like you'll start getting those mails. And at the very least, you want to have a story where you can say, oh, we adopted all the new APIs that Apple said we should and blah, 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 blah. Otherwise, you just start to feel terrible. So
the things that
Apple couldn't do, the aggregate bulk of users who are misinterpreting fuzzy information, right? You know, if you're in the menu, you're bad, right? All right, that terribleness will make everything better for all of us eventually. Yeah,
the dark matter of shame will eventually shift the gravitational forces. I was surprised that they put it there because OS X is sort of always a little bit been trending away from giving the user information. I mean, you know, every now and then they try to pretend that apps aren't running, like they remove the indicator lights. So I was kind of surprised to see that, especially when you click one and it takes you into that activity monitor, which is kind of intimidating for regular folks.
And it highlights your application. And
yeah,
so all
with
you
a kill button.
to click the big stop sign icon in the toolbar. It's so terrible because users should not ever be in an activity monitor and don't know what that stop button does, but it's all just, you know, it's social peer pressure and also opting all of your Cocoa apps into AppNap by default. What is it? As long as they're linking against the 10.9 SDK, they get opted in.
I actually believe everything's opted in.
Yeah.
It's only if you link against 10.9.
I've seen hype going to AppNap, and we link against 10.7, actually.
I asked Apple about that.
Oh, really? I'll double check it. But
whatever the answer was, it's written in my review somewhere.
I heard from a few well-known third-party developers, no names, that they did not believe Apple would ship that feature, that Apple was doing it just to bother them, to put pressure on them, and they were all certain that it would not be in the shipping version, and then their jaws kind of dropped.
I misremembered. It's that you get the checkbox in the Finder to disable AppNap if you're not linked against 10.9. If you're linked against 10.9, you don't get that checkbox.
Yeah, you have the opportunity to build against the APIs.
You would have to use the private, you know, whatever they call them, SPIs or whatever to... Yeah.
And AppNap is like an umbrella feature too, right? There's like a lot to it. It's not really one thing. So, like AppNap does that incorporate timer coalescing under the umbrella?
It's an umbrella term like iCloud, but like a lot of the APIs are just like, here's a fancier API that really is just wrapping power assertions, and we didn't want you to have to use power assertions, so here's a fancier thing for that, and here's a bunch of fancy APIs to tell you about your you know, the state of when you're obscured. And is that really part of AppNap? It's really just so your application can do smarter things, because now you can get notifications that you couldn't get before, and now we expect you, the application, to do something intelligent with that information. Yeah. Is that part of AppNap? I guess it's under the umbrella, but it's not the same as we're going to throttle your application.
Right. There's some interesting stuff in there, too. Like, you can spin off a task, not a separate process task. Like, you can have, like, a work unit on dispatch, and you can give it... certain attributes, and you can give it a name. And it looks like the API is set up, or at least they mentioned in the documentation, that it could be possible for the system to just like sort of show progress indicators for like what's happening. There's no affordances in the UI for that now, but there's kind of like this thing set up where you can tell the system, you can explain, like, I'm doing this unit of work, and when this unit of work is done, you know, let me know. Meanwhile,
playing to the new NS Progress API.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Honestly, I've explored embarrassingly very little of the 10.9 APIs because we've yet to really adopt aggressively 10.9. Yeah.
As yet, that doesn't really do you anything or, you know, help you in any way. But it's kind of like you can imagine. Well, I imagine that that's the way that when the Finder has that little download thing going on along the, you know, when you download a an app and the icon has the download badge on it. I imagine it's using a similar kind of mechanism to that.
Like, oh, I totally, yeah, I absolutely believe that.
Anyway, we totally got derailed. Jalko, what do you think about 10.9?
Well, I've been really pleased with it. I was actually kind of interested, though, to hear like Renee's impression of, I think he said Final Cut, you know, just kind of basically stopped working in the way that he would expect it to work. And I think that's kind of something. I sometimes when I'm feeling pretty happy about an OS release, I try to step back and think like, well, how are regular people thinking about this? And the fact that like something in the underpinnings of 10.9 might have made an app completely stop working. Like Renee, how much, you know, I guess you kind of had to like tickle the application to make it work again. Is that kind of the gist?
I have to go into the Finder and, you know, unclick the or uncheck the AppNap button.
And this is like something that where if it breaks in Final Cut, then it's kind of like it's kind of like a pro user app. It's like it's you can kind of like forgive that a little bit more. But like, what kind of apps are out there that just everyday users are using that it screws up? And because I was going to
crack the joke that Final Cut Pro is not actually a pro.
Just because I think that's all the pros drag on.
So I have one little gripe. So I was going to say, coming into this, I came into this thinking, you know what? One of the things I love about 10.9 is I basically adopted it. I started installing the betas and I didn't notice almost anything except, you know, this kind of vague sense that my power was being managed better. And I felt good about that. And I felt like, oh, this is a great update because in part it does so little to disrupt the status quo of, you know, using my apps and getting my job done and having a good time with my computer. There's one little thing I noticed, like I actually noticed it during the betas, and I was thinking like either this is something weird about my Mac, which it might be, or it's something weird about a pre-release of Mavericks, which is proven not to be now. But I occasionally still, with my Mac at least, get like when I'm command tabbing through stuff, I get like kind of hung up and then it's like it's frozen. I don't know what underlying technology this is based in, but it's an example like that Final Cut thing where I could see it being like this byproduct of some underlying technology change where somebody wasn't paying close enough attention at Apple maybe to like, what are all these great things we're doing going to actually, how are they going to play out on users' Macs? And like for me, it means I have these like little tricks. Like when I get hung up in this command tab thing, I have to like move a window to get it to unhang. I don't know if this rings a bell for anybody. Does this sound familiar at all, or am I the only one on this conversation?
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I was going to guess the VRAM paging on a laptop maybe causing some kind of hiccup.
I was going to say your computer is haunted because I've heard many tales of your computer, and I think it's time to just burn that in some kind of ritual ceremony.
let's not beat around the bush. My computer is from 2010, so it's rather old. However, Apple was so ambitious with this release that I just tonight installed on my wife's 2008 MacBook Mavericks. I was like, I remember a year ago being almost like flabbergasted that 10.8 would install on this thing. You know, I was like, really? Like, she was like running 10.5 or something. I think she bought the Mac with like 10.5.8 or something, and it's like, you know, the first Intel release or something, and I'm thinking, are they really going to let me update to this? And then they let me update to 10.8, and then I thought, okay, well, that's it, this is the last release for this computer. And then like I based on some other issues that are going on with the Mac, I thought maybe it'll help if I update it to 10.9 if they let me. And then to my shock and surprise, they let me.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? It's like right in the midst of that New York Times opinion piece, because, you know, it's
only iOS devices self-destruct guy.
Yeah, the planned obsolescence thing. And meanwhile, you know, Mavericks is shipping with like what, 6 years of support all the way back.
I really wish people just put that to rest.
Like, yeah, I know that. I don't. People. Yes, I know. Yeah,
I would go so far to say that it is, even though I'm enjoying, you know, more or less the benefits of this strategy, I would go so far
as to say it's foolish on Apple's part to support the computers as far back as they are. Like,
are they leaving money on the table?
No, just that it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it's not that they're leaving money on the table, that they're taking on support burden that they don't need, and that there's an expectation that they're too far exceeding the expectations. Like, I'm a power user, granted, but I think it feels to me like right now, doesn't it seem unusual that right now perhaps we might be at a point in time, maybe Syracuse, maybe you can sanity check this for me, but we might be at a point in time where OS X spans back in its support for older computers farther in years than it may have ever done before.
I think there's a good reason for it, though, and it's because the Mac platform has pretty much gone through all of its difficult transitions. Like, the tough years is when they, you know, drop PowerPC, drop Rosetta, drop 32-bit. You know, like, they did all that stuff already. Those were the years when it was like, what do you mean? We'll only run an Intel machine? What do you mean Rosetta's gone? What do you mean I can't run this on my 32-bit? And now it's just like, it runs on anything the Mountain Lion runs on, because Mountain Lion is like, okay, you need 64-bit Intel, and that is a reasonable platform. And it's not really that many machines, not too much variety. We're just used to all those transition years where, you know, first it was from Classic to 10, and they had to drop stuff like crazy there. And then it was, you know, the whole Intel transition, and then it was 32 to 64-bit. And it's just been one transition after another. And I think finally they're in the clear. And what do you see ahead of you? You don't see 128-bit CPUs. Maybe you see ARM off in the distance if you have, depending on which color glasses you're wearing, right? but it's smooth sailing from here. And like, you think, why would they not support a particular OS? The next transition I can maybe see is nothing with a spinning disk. But that may be a while to come, or maybe they would allow Fusion Drive. But that's the only other transition that I see in the near future that'll be like, oh, we can do cool things with the OS if we assume you have a solid state drive, or if we assume you have like raw access to NAND, then we do this crazy ass. I'm going to get into another. I would like a different file system. But anyway, you know, like, there are interesting things. Yeah, there are interesting things you can do if you drop that last little bit. But in this period, it does not surprise me that they didn't drop backward compatibility, because there was no reason to. There's no technical reason to. And all the other times, as pissed as we were, there were solid, reasonable technical reasons to drop stuff.
Right. So, Ryan, I mean, well, A, you're probably uniquely qualified to actually answer that. And in terms of what you think the support...
There were solid technical reasons, yes.
Well, yeah, A, that, but B, in terms of what the support load might be by reaching back that far. But also, do you remember what XP, the window that XP supported was? Because it must have been pretty big.
The window that XP supported? Holy shit.
In terms of like how many years back of hardware, like, it must have been pretty crazy.
All of it?
Kind of Microsoft's story,
you needed,
right?
You needed a 386, I think.
Yeah, honestly, I think that was like, you needed a 3 or 486. It went back to like either late 80s or 46 was 91, 92. Like,
yeah, that's ridiculous. And I think we all agree that
incredible span.
Yes, it did stagnate for a long time. So it's not that the hardware – I mean, Apple has been – ditching hardware in order to keep the OS moving, while Microsoft ended up crippling their OS for a chunk of years in order to keep reaching back to support older hardware.
You know, Microsoft dragged it.
Yeah, they just dragged it along. Yeah. It was something that they had. I guess touching on Syracuse's points, there's really not a whole lot that would motivate Apple to drop hardware that's, you know, 2008 for Daniel's wife's case. It would be SSDs. It would be integrated, like certain graphics cards features, depending on if they wanted to go for OpenCL support or something along those lines, being pervasive across the OS. You know, hypothetically, if they went into Halem for encryption instructions that were baked into the chip, something along those lines. But there's no huge compelling reason to drop all this older hardware to pursue those things. Those are things that, if they exist in the computer, can lead to a much better user experience or enable features that would not be possible, but they're not like make or break for an entire operating system. Yeah.
Yeah. They kept a lot of the old stuff in there, like, you know, the OpenCL for Core Image, like, but they kept the GLSL stuff in there, the old, you know, the original use of LLVM to compile off the little bytecode things. Like, they're like, we already have them. They work. Like, if they've got existing 64-bit clean drivers for the integrated video that's in your 2007 MacBook Pro, why drop it? You know, it's not like they need to do extra work to support them. Oh, now we gotta, once everything's 64-bit, and even if they have the new stuff, you're like, well, we'll ship the binaries for the old stuff too. So if you don't If your GPU doesn't have, can't support OpenCL, fine, we'll use the same stuff we were using all the other years. We don't even have to rebuild it.
Now, well, there is the overhead of support cost, which that is non-negligible, but again, given the platform differences between the MacBook Air and the iMac that I'm sitting in front of versus the 2008, I assume, laptop that Daniel's wife has, they're not so dramatic that it requires constant daily testing upon. Like, you do want to make sure the performance works on that, and you want to run automated tests to ensure that there's no serious regressions that are obvious, like do sleep-wake testing and things along those lines. But they should really just work. And it's a burden, certainly, but I don't think it's as much of a burden as, like, continuing Rosetta support, which is an enormous cost, because anything that changes in the kernel required tweaking in Rosetta. Anything that changes in the frameworks probably required tweaking in Rosetta. And you change anything in Rosetta, you've got to retest all the PowerPC applications. Like, there's this huge burden of preserving that, or keeping PowerPC hardware running, things along those lines. Like, with where we're at now, or at least where Apple is at now, that's not a huge cost. It's something I'm sure they'd want to cut loose, but it's not prohibitive, at least from what I can imagine right now.
So I want to save you for last, John. And this is kind of unfair, but, you know, what are your high-level feelings on Mavericks? And I know you sum it up, but I thought maybe we'd go with what you're going to say and then sort of look towards the future.
Yeah, I think the thing that I like best about it is not so much the energy-saving thing, because I don't use laptops, but the responsiveness angle, where I don't so much care that there isn't something in the background eating my battery life. I care that the maximum amount of resources are concentrated on servicing whatever I'm doing interactively. And it, like, you know, making the machine more responsive to me. And that goes from all the way down, like, the boring, low level stuff of, like, now the different priority levels and being able to specify this should only run if you're connected to power, which, again, doesn't matter for me. But, you know, this shouldn't run if you're doing something indirect. All those ways they have to make the background jobs be less invasive and make the jobs like say, oh, I was going to run, but I see that you're doing something, so I'm not going to run, or I'm going to run at a super duper low priority. There's nothing, like, the thing that still hurts me in OS X, the reason my Mac bogs down and starts feeling like a piece of crap, is because I get swamped by I.O. I.O. is my enemy. Like, you got 16 gigs of RAM, I got all this CPU, I got everything going for me, but you just do a bunch of I.O., and then all of a sudden my machine feels like a Mac Plus again, and, I'm, you know, everything is slow. And so I'm really happy not to see Time Machine and Spotlight re-indexing for the umpteenth time for some god knows what reason, destroying my ability to have interactive performance. I like that they hang back more. I like that what I'm doing now is taken as more important. And I'm happy when any third-party application implements the API to say, oh, when you're obscured, stop drawing. And you know, when you're in the background, hang back and don't fire your timer a million times a second. All that stuff, again, not for battery-saving power, but just because, you know, the priority boosting thing where you can talk to some daemon that's going to give you some font information or something, wherever, and it gets a temporary boost while you're talking to it, and then it goes back into sleepy state. That's what I like about Mavericks, is that it's trying, in very small baby steps, trying to bring it more towards the experience of iOS, where you have these incredibly underpowered machines that seem like they should be as slow as molasses running anything based on OS X, but they weren't, because they basically said nothing could be happening on this system except for what the user is interacting with, and, you know, full screen applications, everything else paused, and, you know, like Guy said before, they've been ramping that up slowly, and the Mac is coming from the other direction down towards it. And I think hopefully they'll both meet in the middle, where things can run in the background subject to constraints, but both machines try to concentrate all their power on doing what you're doing at this moment. It's kind of like if you could imagine running classic Mac OS on, like, a modern day Mac Pro, where when you hold down the menu, everything stops. But man, that menu is responsive, right? Like, you know, like cooperative multitasking, like the entire full force of the hardware in your Mac was focused on whatever the heck you were doing, because it didn't have multitasking that other things couldn't preempt it. And it felt so responsive. That's why OS X felt so slow. It's like, you know, preemptive multitasking. What? I was doing something. I don't want other things running. And it's taken us a long time to kind of circle back to that, going, you know, a side excursion to iOS. Say, see, you can have really crappy hardware and it feels really fast as long as you don't do any other stuff. And that is my favorite feature of Mavericks.
It's funny, when I started reading your stuff, like, years back, I basically rage read, like, you and Gruber all the time, because I'm like, what the hell are these guys talking about? Like, I was coming from, like, Windows NT or OS 2, and I'm like, if I hold down the scroll bar, my download stops. That is obscene. That just should not happen. But I've come to understand the zen of the Mac Classic. So yes, I agree with you that there's a good middle ground that we should be aiming for.
And Classic,
I
think, Mac OS was iOS before iOS was iOS.
Yes.
You know, because it totally did the, look, we were going to have a GUI on a computer with like 128 kilobytes of RAM and a bunch of ROM. How is that even possible? The only way it's possible is the entire world has to stop because we're drawing some GUI stuff now. So everybody stop. It was the only way you could get it to be responsive. It's the only way it worked at all. And that, you know, that value system of saying it's more important for this to feel responsive when I'm interacting with it than it is to have all these WYSI features, you know. And eventually, like, you know, we came to that inflection point where it's like, no, seriously, you actually need preemptive multitasking. It's kind of important at this point. But all those years before, it was why the Mac felt so good and the other computers didn't.
Felt so good. Yeah. I agree. And I'm kind of heartened that we're kind of getting back to that where not back to like cooperative multitasking, obviously, but back to the idea that being responsive to what the user wants to do or needs or requirements are sort of paramount these days, rather than sort of the Unix model where it's the, like a,
time sharing thinking, system. You're just another process on the system.
It's thinking it's a multi-user machine, so therefore
it's a multi-user system, or it's a server or something along those lines that it must, by definition, service a lot of different demands at the same time. Where on a Mac, typically it's not the case.
Yes, and while the processes are running under different users and fake users and all that, you know, the machine, and certainly an iOS device, is a single user device from the perspective of one person sitting in front of a keyboard, and the OS is slowly sort of evolving to suit that need.
Or even with multiple users, when you can do the remote desktop or you can have another person remote desktoped in. Like, it's basically the interactive human should get as much of the resources as possible. If there's two humans, then the two humans get as much of the resources as possible. And it's basically starving, trying to say the things that the humans don't see right now, not that they're not important and you shouldn't do them, but they can wait. You know, like they've always, OS X has always had good prioritization of interactive tasks and stuff like that. But this is really ratcheting it up, especially as the years have progressed and added more and more stuff in the background, like Spotlight, like Time Machine. Things that are going to run on regular people's systems, are going to run a lot, are expensive, have to be done eventually. Surely there might be a better time to do them than like right when I'm trying to do some work, or I just woke the system up from sleep and Time Machine's like, I haven't run in a while, and Spotlight's like, I need to re-index it. The only thing we have left is you just need to make MDS not be the process on my system that's using the
Well, I mean,
despite that barrier, will be in the clear.
Right. I mean, I'm like 98% sure that you were on those old Omni lists when OS X was just coming out.
I thought you were like an old man when you were on those lists. Guy English, what kind of name is that?
Yeah,
okay. You must have been like 16.
I thought you were ancient.
I don't know. I'm not that. We're basically the same age.
He's like Aragorn.
Maybe I just, I just sounded ancient.
You were like defending next stuff. So I'm like, boy, this guy must be some old suspender wearing guy with gray hair around his ears.
I was an idealistic young computer nerd.
They sound,
I was just coming at it from
same.
A different angle, just seriously coming at it from a different angle. But remember when everybody was all like, oh, it's Unix, so like the cron job to rotate the logs is going to eat up my battery or spin up my Mac, like all this little stuff that we just don't think about anymore. And I think, you know, a lot of the processes that we, you know, MDS and like Spotlight and all that, will eventually go that kind of way where it's just we don't think about it. It just kind of
I still think about MDS. I just looked it up, and surprisingly, Chrome is ahead of it. But yeah, MDS is using the second most private memory in the system, 681 megabytes for MDS. Okay. It's always either number one or two on my system.
Yeah, that's kind of bananas.
So you got to save something for 1010, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So given that, wait, so your actual conclusion, of the not your actual, but the, what you end your opus with is you say that Mavericks is sort of doesn't know what it wants from itself, or does, it's unsure of itself. Is that a fair way of summing it up? You have an actual elegant turn of phrase, and I can't come up with it right now.
Yeah, you met me at a very strange time in my life, because I think this is a strange time in the life of the Mac, because this was definitely a rewind, sort of a mea culpa about a lot of the stuff from Lion and Mountain Lion, both cosmetic and, you know, like the prioritization of the system. Is kind of like, you know, iOS is such a success, and the Mac wants to be like iOS, and the things it was copying in 10.7 and 10.8, you know, Apple decided that those were not the right things to copy, that it was good to copy iOS, but instead of taking from it that address book should look like a book and that, you know, iCloud integration is the be-all end-all and the applications should be consistent and all that stuff, although we can get into that again with the iWork situation. But like that, they decided that that's not what we should take from iOS. What we should take from iOS is, you know, the power saving stuff, prioritizing the user's interactive experience, and simplicity. And simplicity, they were doing that in 10, 7, and 8 as well, like getting things out of your face that you don't have to care about, adding things like Launchpad, even though it's kind of, you know, whatever. Like, that's, I think that's along the right idea. Are there aspects of the system that really only computer nerds care about, and that if you could just eliminate them entirely with minimal whining from the old power users, it would be a benefit to everybody? So Mavericks was like, okay, undo that stuff. Start doing more stuff like iOS in a different realm. But beyond that, it feels like it kind of, we have to do this rewind and then figure out what we're going to be when we grow up. And Mavericks doesn't say what that's going to be. So it's a weird time. It's not setting off in some new direction going, okay, we're heading for that hill right there. It's more like, all right, rewind, scrape, 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 take off that makeup that we had on. It's kind of embarrassing. Regroup. And like, we don't know where it's going next. And I don't think Apple knows either. It's a good release in that respect, because we all like releases where things that annoyed us get fixed and, you know, internal stuff changes. But it is not a bold new direction for the Mac. Not yet, anyway.
Do you think that's fair, Brian? Or anybody, really?
I think it's fair. No, I think part of that's fair, at least. It's fair to say that this is not a bold new direction for the operating system. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of the iOS adoption, especially Address Book is the canonical example, those things have been rolled back and just kind of like glossed over. That's a history that is going to be ignored. But for things like the energy saving, timer coalescing, AppNap, compressed memory, those things have actually been a long time coming in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I don't have any inside knowledge. I kind of wish I did. I need to go out and meet some people. But something has changed that has now made these things that were once untenable much more palatable to Apple, and or at least to the OS X team.
Do you think it's a technical or political change?
Oh, political, entirely political. Okay. And the classic example that I would cite is the battery menu extra, where it actually, as we've said before, lists the applications that are consuming the most memory. We had stuff similar to that internally when I was at Apple, and there was absolutely no way that would ever make its way outside, because for the very reason that Syracuse cited, that's like, users are going to see this and they're not going to know how to interpret a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And by that very reason, it's not something that we want to put in the user's hands. We don't want to take them to the activity monitor. And I'm saying all this from the perspective of me when I left Apple in 2010. We wouldn't want to do these things. And now something has changed that makes us a lot more that they're a lot more willing to pursue these routes that they were not once willing to do. We'll force apps to have this behavior. And yes, there'll be a way for them to opt out if the user goes to the get info window and checks this checkbox. But otherwise, they're opted into this behavior. And yes, we'll put this information in the battery menu extra, and it'll be up to the user to decide how they want to use this. Hopefully it's something that they can deliver to the developer, the application that they're using, and some good will come of it. And I think we can all agree that some general good has come from it. But before, this just would not have happened. So I think it's unfair to say that a lot of the change that happened in Mavericks has not been a long time coming, but it is totally fair to say it's not clear where we're going. And the changes that we have seen, I'm not certain what we can read from them. I don't know what motivated the sudden change to make this additional information available to users and to affect applications in different ways. Like, Occam's razor, the simplest reason is probably battery life is the single most important thing that Apple can control these days in the Macs that it is selling, or at least the most popular Macs that it is selling.
Battery tech is the only thing that's not going along.
Exactly. Way to improve battery life for every user out there and to give them better numbers against all the Wintel machines that are out there is to do these more aggressive things. So Occam's razor, I'm willing to write those off as this was just a very pragmatic decision saying we need to improve our laptops because this is the most popular machine that we're selling. So let's do these things. They will be a general good for the system. And I think that was a very intelligent decision to make, if I'm reading the tea leaves correctly. Mm-hmm. But that also still doesn't give us any clues as to where the system is going. Like, that was a pragmatic decision made on data that was available now. That's done. Like, but yeah. Where do we go from there? That's a very fair question.
I really think when I look at it, I don't even know if this is a conscious decision inside Apple, but just like, as you know, as an emergent behavior of the group of people that's over there, it's a changing in how they evaluate what's good about iOS, because that's the thing, the constant over there is iOS equals good, like for so many reasons, right? It's such an important product, such an important revolution, and it was like, what's good about iOS? What is it that makes it good? And can we apply that to our other products and services? And it's like, is this what's good about iOS? No, maybe that's not what it is. And what about this other thing? And I think like we weren't willing to do the activity monitor stuff and you know the energy shaming and to apply AppNap and everything, because it's like, oh well, you know, our existing users don't like this and they're going to be annoyed or whatever. And it's like, once the value system shifted and like, you know what? I think what's actually good about iOS is that whole thing where like we don't do anything except for what the user is interacting with, yep. And it makes it feel responsive. And you know, all the parts of iOS that like are simpler, that there are fewer moving parts, fewer things you can screw up. And like they've been on that path with the Mac App Store and stuff too. And it's like now it just reach a tipping point where it's like, actually those things are so good about iOS and the Mac is never going to be like that unless we were willing to take these hits. So I guess like it tipped over into now we're willing to do things that we previously weren't. That again, we had the tech for it. We could have done this at any time and it was a value judgment. And it's like, all right, we're at the tipping point here. The things we're pretty sure the things that are good about iOS thing people like is that it's simpler, more responsive and all that stuff. And for the energy saving stuff, like Guy said, battery technology, I think I looked up a graph of this at one point, but it was like 5% a year improvement or whatever. Every battery life improvement, it's all about making things consume less energy, because you can't rely on more energy being available per unit volume or, you know, mass or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's just not a lot of fundamental research looking promising right now.
I mean, there is. Like, they keep doing it about 5% a year, but, like, you don't get from the iPad, iPad Air. Like, the reason you did that, and you don't even get it from the CPU, it's because of that IGZO, however you pronounce it, screen. Yeah. Like, because the humongous backlight on the iPad 3 and 4 was just killer. And I was like, oh, if we can cut the power to the screen, suddenly we can make it thinner. We can shave off battery. Like, that's the only way to get better is to...
I just mean about like the research, the chemistry research, the chemical research that goes into making batteries better. There's not like a super promising like, oh, in 5 years we're going to get like 20 times improvement on battery. It's just not going to happen.
Like 5% a year or something. Like you can slowly crawling up, but like
those are not revolutionary changes. Those are evolutionary incremental improvements rather than.
Yeah, and the thing I think about that heartens me is that there are very few things left in the system where there are hard limits on what their usage has to be. The light emitting thing is probably the hardest thing. It's like, look, the screen has to light up probably, unless they come up with some sort of reflective thing, and that's like a physical thing that has to happen. But everything else, if you can imagine, all you need is, it's like a whole bunch of, you know, inputs and outputs to change from 1 to 0s or whatever. And you can imagine that as a series of individual atoms that just change state, right? And like the minimum amount of power that, like, how low can it go? How low can a CPU power go? It's not, CPU is not doing anything. It's just bringing lines up and down, high and low. Like, that can get so low power that it becomes like static electricity, you know, has more power inside it. So CPUs, GPUs, memory, all that stuff can basically go to zero power. In our lifetime, compute should basically be, there's been a lot of articles about this, compute becomes free power budget wise. And all you're left with are the things that you can't get for free unless we have like neural implants, which is emitting a bunch of light from the screen or, you know, stuff like that. And so if you could zero out the energy consumption of compute, all you have left is a battery connected to a screen and like, and then we're getting somewhere. Right.
So, right, yeah. I mean, anything like, you know, light or radios or anything that emits, I mean, the entire I mean, the entire point of light and radios and all that is to leak energy into the world.
By definition,
yeah. Yeah, that's what they do. So, you know, that's going to cost you.
So compute, like, stops consuming energy, but we're not quite there yet. So, like, now, you know, the dynamic power range of energy consumption of the CPUs is a factor. And so now it's like, if we just do less stuff, we can get away with that. But once the power of compute goes down low, like, I don't think we'll need all this stuff that we've done. We're in a weird period now where the CPU and GPU are actually potentially the biggest energy hogs in the system. And I think that when we look back historically, our grandchildren look back and it's like, hey, remember when the CPU was the thing that sucked all the power and then we had heat sinks on them and stuff? That will seem absurd, but it will be harder to get a 27-inch light-emitting screen down to energy levels that are even close to that.
Jalkut, you've been quiet, which is not your usual state of affairs. do you have anything to add about, how you feel that Apple has sort of left the state of the OS? Like, does Mavericks have a personality to you? I guess that's the question.
Well, one of the things that came to mind while I was listening to that conversation was the conversation, like Ryan was saying, about the battery power and how it's it would have seemed like unfathomable at some point that kind of information would be conveyed directly to the user. And he obviously has a lot more experience with Apple more recently in particular than I do. But it reminded me of this age-old kind of conflict in Apple. I can say it's age-old because it was happening when I was there. So I left Apple in 2002, and I was there from 1995 or 94 or so. And I just remember one of the things that like struck me that kind of compares to that is the huge, huge, huge debate that occurred when OS X was just preparing for public release. And the debate was around whether the terminal would be included in the base OS or not. Right?
There was that. And there was also the fact that they wanted to give away developer tools for free had old Mac hands up in arms because they thought that meant you'd have to recompile your kernel and a bunch of other stupid Linux bullshit.
Wow.
So that's probably unfair. I'm sure John can say it better. But John, to your great credit, I don't think you were ever negative on the developer tools being included.
No, we knew it was GCC. What are you going to not include it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there was some weirdness about it. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's all right. But I don't have anything real, I guess, concrete to say, but the thoughts that came to mind were that, and that it reminded me, thinking of Ryan's description and kind of being like, this wouldn't have happened. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, it wouldn't have happened. I agree with that, but it wouldn't have happened depending on who you asked. And one of the things that's interesting about Apple, and I think makes it a really fun and like kind of a cool company in a lot of respects, is that the like ask somebody old like me and I'll be like, there's a certain Apple way. There's like an Apple way of doing things. But even when I was working at the company and even, when I started at the company in the mid-90s, even though there was this like Apple way of doing things, it was extremely varied, the interpretation of that, right? So like people often ask me as like a, young people come up to me and they say like, I'm going to get a job interview at Apple. And I just want to know, like, since you have experience there and you worked there for a long time, what kind of questions are they going to ask me? And the answer is, and Ryan, you can probably attest to this, I have no idea because Apple is not like Google or Microsoft in the sense that there is like some overriding,
committee.
Like, you're right, exactly. And I think that applies, fortunately and unfortunately, that also applies to engineering and to questions of, which features should be exposed. And, we look at this stuff like I was thinking another like prevailing thought coming into this conversation was I was thinking like on the very upbeat like perspective about Mavericks, I'm thinking like this is a company. This is the OS that a company releases when they are so like on their game that they're like confident and they're able to just say, like, you know what? That last great OS release, 10.8, we're just going to keep like iterating on that and do great stuff and make the stuff that was already great even better. And of course, I was just like blinding myself to things that they're not making better. Like they're not really making like great strides in iCloud syncing, right? It's not something that people are saying, wow, that company, they really know how to do this. They really just like they have like a bravado about it and they are able to just go out and keep doing a better job every year. And a lot of the things we see in Mavericks are an example of Apple's bravado and saying like we can actually do this so well. We're so much better at doing a lot of these things than, say, Microsoft. That we can just come out and say, 10.9, we just like, we barely like sneezed and we accidentally made an OS that is like 100 bajillion times better than anything you will ever make. And then there are others, there are other things that don't meet that, that bar. And part of that, I think, is, first of all, there are talented people, extremely talented people, and slightly less talented people at Apple. But there is also this like weird, this like there's this like split personality of Apple where like some groups think, of course, we should let every user know all of the battery usage information of every process. And if that group was in charge of the whole OS, we'd probably have like Linux, right? Or something. I don't know. It's possible to imagine like that amount of like exposure of information going crazy. And then there are other groups that are like, no. Everything should be hidden from the user. And we can imagine like gross outcomes of that as well. And it's like, I think the history of Apple and what is good about the company, it has partly been like this diversity of opinions within the company that have to kind of struggle and fight it out to figure out whose like opinions take the day. And like, I don't think that I guess what I would say is I'm not that surprised that that battery power thing is in there. Because it feels to me like just like, okay, they won that fight. Like whoever was in charge of that won that fight. And maybe, Ryan, maybe that means that, you know, from your experience there, maybe there was like more power, like defending that kind of thing when you were.
Oh, totally.
You know,
it means that I wasn't there in the conference room saying, no, there's no way in hell we're going to give users this experience.
So, which is not
to say that it's a bad experience. Just that was, I was on that particular.
Your initial reaction. Discussions.
Yeah. No, well, now you've got Federighi in charge of both though. Like, isn't that having the single person, like, you know, a lot of these things are fought out at a lower level, but if anything escalates, like having the same guy in charge of iOS and OS X, you know, whether it's on the UI side or the tech side, like Federighi or Ive, that I think lets you have a more sane story about what we think is important about software products and operating systems and platforms versus having separate heads that have their own opinions, and then it just gets even more diverse from there. At least at the top, it's unified in a way that it wasn't before.
In a way, it's kind of like that. I'm sure you remember the number, John. That infamous tech note that nixed creator tags and all of that. Like the, you know, yeah. I forget what it was.
1604 or 1804, I don't know.
Yeah. Like one now, now that at least I've got one guy on top of both systems, you'll get a similar. And whether or not you agree with it, you'll get a similar sort of line in the sand drawn about what the shared goals of the platforms are going to be. 2034, right. Because that battery thing really does – it's funny because when I first saw the battery thing, I'm like, oh, man, that's not an Apple thing to do, which is probably exactly what you felt when they nixed the creator codes or the
That was the next invasion. Like, I'm still some of those things we still haven't recovered from. Like not being able to name your files whatever you want. Like it's just
the fact that it's still like,
it's kind of like when there's like, you know, species extinction events where like there's not even two left for a mating pair. They just die out. And like so at Apple, everybody, you know, or the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, you know, none now live who remember them. Like no one lives who remembers. You used to be able to name your files whatever you want, and it's what made the Mac a better experience for everybody involved.
Well,
until you had to share a file, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to refight this battle, but the point is that was a thing where there was two sides to the battle, and I think one side wiped out the other, and they're totally gone, and no one even remembers it anymore, like inside the company. And I was thinking when Daniel was explaining the different groups and mentalities, it was like that could also explain, like, why is this API C++? You know, that type of thing where you're like,
absolutely, it totally does.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt.
It's because a certain group of people think, well, this should be a C++ API. And it's like, do you know what company you're in?
Oh,
here?
God. Yeah.
And like, it speaks, and I think this is, you know, as frustrating as that can be, that's also the strength of the company. Kind of like, you know, the fact that you can have a company where these diverse minds are going at their goal at completely different directions. Could be very, you know, damning to the company's desired outcomes. But, you know, like, for example, you say C++, like core audio is like,
well, LLVM and WebKit.
Yeah. Both LLVM C++. Is a great example.
Yeah, you're going to say, LLVM, that's great and everything, but we really don't want you to use C++ because here at Apple, we're an Objective-C company. Like, it's great that they didn't have to have that fighter conversation. It's like, well, no, LLVM is a series of C++ libraries. That's how it's done. It's like, all right, go do that. If it's awesome, it will be awesome and we'll love it. I think everyone gets sore, like, okay, your API is not awesome and it's in C++. It's like, well, now that you have two strikes against you already.
Yeah. I think one of the things, okay, this is going to sound a bit too Apple cheerleadery, so I don't really want to, I don't know how to phrase this any better. But I think where a company like Google sort of focuses on the process, and from our conversation, from other conversations that we were having, Ryan, on this show, Microsoft sort of does a similar thing in terms of its Windows development. I think Apple kind of ends up focusing on the product a bit more. Like, it doesn't really matter how the sausage gets made, and sometimes it can be ugly. But they're
sometimes.
Sort of, yeah, okay, it's always ugly. But they seem to be focused more on the end goal than being dogmatic to a particular approach.
I mean, I can't speak to the other companies like Google and Microsoft having never worked there, but
yeah, that's why I wanted to avoid the Apple cheerleading.
Yeah, there probably are teams at Apple and Google that are very customer focused, but I can say that at Apple, at least in the conversations that I was a part of and the teams that I worked with and the things that I did, the product is paramount. Like, nothing else matters. Nothing else at all matters. Egos and technical reasons and things like that. No, like, it's what the customer experience is, and we should drive towards having the best customer experience at all points in time. And there might be reasons that temporarily we can't get there, or there might be political reasons why we've signed contracts with certain people or whatever, but that always needs to be held in paramount. And if there's ever a question about do we do A or B, the deciding, like, the thing you hold those two decisions up against is always the product and what is best for the user and for evolving this product down the future.
It's like a culture in the company of not just like you always hear about, oh, they don't have individual profit and loss. There's just one profit and loss line for the whole company. So you don't have like, well, my division did well this year, so screw you and your division. And then you don't have that kind of infighting. But it's like, how do you get the respect of your peers within the company? And the answer inside Apple is you make a great product. Like, and that's just a cultural thing. Like, you may come in there thinking, boy, if I make a lot of money or sell a lot of copies, I'll feel better about myself. And you realize everyone else looks up to the team that made the great product. Like, they look up to the team that launched iOS or whatever. And it almost doesn't matter. Not that sales don't matter at all, but it's like, that's the currency of respect within the company. Which is really weird, because usually once you get up to the executive level, it's like, well, the currency of respect is like stock price or departmental profit and loss or all sorts of things that have nothing to do with anything and are just about like sort of inward facing. And everything at Apple seems to be they are proud and happy when they make a great product that people love, and they're not when they don't. And everything else, you know, flows from that. And it's really weird, again, especially the executive levels, because you really get the impression that at the executive level, especially these people are so rich and they don't need any more money. And it's like, they want to be triumphant and the champion by having a product that people love, which is so weird in big companies.
Well, I think that's the key for Apple, is it does start at the top. It's the fact that those people at the very top are so passionate about, or at least are able to show that they're so passionate about, the products that are being produced by the teams that work for them or work with them. And that just filters down to the rest of the company. Like, I'm not a huge fan of trickle down in general, but it's...
That's not quite the same thing, but anyway, yeah.
It isn't true, but it's the message that gets set up there. And if you look at past leaders of Apple that have been less than successful, they tend to lose focus on that. They tend to lose focus on the product, and that at least at Apple is the single most important thing that you can be concerned about.
Do you remember that QA session when Steve Jobs came back to Apple and he got a very hostile question about OpenDoc, and he kind of answered it and said, you know, we don't think about the technologies, we think about the experience, and then we aim ourselves in that direction. And I think that was, at least for me, that galvanized the direction of the company.
Well, that's the ethos of the company, and that's why the company floundered when it had leaders that did not understand the ethos that had been distilled into that company.
It's not just that they didn't understand the ethos, is that those people, like, I don't know, you know, Paul Spindler or Amelia or whatever, they didn't know what made a good product. So even if they had the ethos,
true.
You can't, you can't, improve what you can't measure, whatever the thing they say about metrics. Their measurement was wrong. They're saying, are we making a good product? And they would look at it and say, yeah, I think it's a great product. And they were wrong. Like, it wasn't a great product. You know, like, you have to be able to accurately gauge it, even if you have the ethos. And then for the people, I guess back to Spindler, it's like, okay, if the company is financially about to go under, suddenly it becomes like, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. All right, step one, keep company solvent. And that person perhaps can be forgiven for, I mean, you can't really forgive them because Steve Jobs came into the same situation and he still said,
yeah, exactly.
The only way to get the company back to be solvent is to actually realize that we have to make great products and that's it. But it's so much easier said than done, and especially at that level where you feel like, think of the poor sucker who's going to go wander over to be CEO of Microsoft, right? It would be so hard. It would be so hard to toe that line and say, I've decided that the way forward for Microsoft, the only way it can ever succeed again, is to make great products. And I know what a great product is. And everyone would want to know, yeah, but how are you going to make money? What about this revenue stream? Blah, blah, blah. Not easy.
Yeah.
So you just depressed me there.
I have something else to say about that. It's not depressing. It's good. It's about Apple.
I felt bad about Microsoft. That's all.
Yeah. Well, let's get off of Microsoft. Let's talk about Apple. Hey, we haven't talked enough about Apple here. But, you know, one of the things that was coming to mind for me was like this whole idea of the ethos and like what are like Apple's standards and how do they get things done? And, you know, we're hearing like a lot of talk about the management and how much impact that has. And I think that's true. But one of the things that I think is also interesting about Apple, and I know this isn't, you know, maybe not necessarily Maverick specific, but I think it probably plays a part, is one of the things I've noticed over the years, and I noticed when I was there, and I think it's still happening, is in Apple's like product development, I kind of make a game of this now, trying to decide for any given feature in an OS release or in an app product, like, you know, feature release, which features were dictated from marketing or executive levels down and which features bubbled up from engineers up. And one of the great things about Apple, and it's not unique about Apple, but I think Apple somehow fosters this better than some companies do, is that there's usually kind of a mix. And like you see some features, like you go look at like the Mavericks feature list and you'll see some things that I guarantee you no product like marketing manager was ever like, make sure you get this into this release, right? There was something like this was definitely something that some engineer in a group was like, oh, by the way, while you weren't paying attention, I, you know, made text rendering 15% faster. Right. And then it's like, oh, good, we can sell that. And it's kind of like Apple's version of you know, Google's 20% time or something, right? Like it's not formal. It's like, hey, if you do something cool, that's cool. Just let us know about it and we'll talk about it. And we'll try to get the product marketing people to say,
absolutely,
we agree, we should like let that go. And I don't know. There's some.
It creates opportunity.
I mean, well, in a sense, that was my job at Apple. That was at least a part of my job at Apple. Was at the inception of any OS release that was coming down the pipeline, was to sit down with the executive team, with marketing, with the engineering teams, and we do this with every engineering team, and ask them all, "What do you want? Like, what are you going to do? What do you want to see happen? And what is, you know, just give us your dreams." And then out of those stakeholders, you know, executive team, they know where the company's going. In theory, hopefully, they know what's coming down the pipeline in terms of products, in terms of other competition. Marketing has customer demands, and they've got their own crazy ideas that they've been sitting on for whatever reason. And engineering, they're the experts. They are the people who have lived whatever they're working on, and they know it better than anyone else, hopefully in the world, and they know where to take that particular set of technologies and how to move it forward. And you want to distill all of that down to a comprehensive, cohesive product, and that's key. Like, without those three players, you're probably going to be lacking in some specific area. Either you're not meeting the needs of the company, either you're not addressing the needs of the direct feedback that we've received from customers, or you're not evolving the technologies that make up the entire thing you're delivering and allowing it to evolve into the future. Like, you need to have all those things playing together.
So the file system team really needs some coaching. Really well, needs some coaching about is. How to perform in those meetings. Sorry, come on, guys, we're gonna huddle up. Right, here's what you got to do in the piece. See what the compiler guys did. See how they had like a multi-year arc where they totally replaced our compiler. Model your behavior on that. Well, they got that done, and it is not a sexy feature. And you know, difficulty marking is dragon mascot or not.
That's where I disagree. The file system can be an incredibly sexy feature, but not if you call it a file system. It's the features that result from having made the very painful evolutionary changes that make it a very sexy feature. You know, things like a read-only system volume, things like better system upgrades, better backups. Actually, like those three things
I think I could do well in that pitch meeting. It seems like the existing team is not doing well in the pitch meeting from the engineering standpoint.
Okay, so wait, let's rewind a bit, and then I'm going to drop the grenades in the room, and you guys can just divide it. So yeah, we were talking about how Apple wants to make a better product, and the way they focus on Ryan was just addressing how they kind of get all those features brought together. This was the 10th release of OS X. Going forward, I hate that phrase, but whatever. suck it up, everybody. As we, you know, what do we anticipate the user requirements being over the next 10 years? 10 years. Over the next handful of releases, you know what I mean? Like in coming up, because increasingly the desktop's becoming less important. We've basically got a laptop operating system now. We're increasingly more connected constantly. So, you know, what's important? Like what are the sort of cornerstone features that we're going to want? Like, is John right about us needing a better file system? In a lot of ways, and in a smaller way, in the very small, not small ways, but in the very concrete, incredibly well-defined ways that John, you expressed the problem, I agree with you 100%. As a product and as a user expectation, is that maybe addressing it in a weird way that's – not in a weird way, but in a way that's not really addressing the problems that the users are going to face, but addressing sort of symptoms of the way that we're currently examining or building on things.
Speaking of that, you know, if you're looking from the end user perspective, we could skip over this uncomfortable situation that we're in and just say, let's skip to the end and go to the part where, I mean, maybe you can't skip all the way to the end, but I mean, to give an example, John Carmack is always talking about how much better game programming would be if you didn't have a pool of RAM, a pool of VRAM, and a disk. Yeah. If instead you just had a single virtual memory address space that appeared homogenous from a programming perspective that encompassed the file system, VRAM, and RAM. And I mean, that's not like the blue sky silliness or whatever, but
it's not that crazy.
You can see it out there, right? And with solid state disk and everything, and like there's a lot of complications that have to do with our current memory hierarchy. And you can kind of almost taste the thing that he's talking about, at least in like a game console type scenario. Maybe that's where it'll appear first. But the file system is part of that in that, like, you know, maybe we just had raw access to NAND and treated it as just like an L5 cache or something and reimagine our subsystem that way and somehow map the POSIX APIs to it and everything appears to be memory mapped or something like that. Then maybe maybe your file system suddenly becomes it's the firmware that's on the SSD and that's all it is. And we just skip over this phase where we have a crap file system for years.
In a sense, aren't you describing like the Newton file system?
Yeah,
everything old is new again, you know. That was the guy in the angry WWDC session who held up the Newton and said, what should I do with this? And I think Steve said, I'll tell you what you can do with it. there are ideas that are before their time and they're not ready. And, you know, but like I think we're far enough away from that now that like the easy list of pitch meeting type things is, wouldn't you love it if Time Machine was way faster and more reliable? Wouldn't you love it if anything that touched the file system could do, you know, if you had transactional file system snapshots, hey, iCloud team, was that something you might be interested in? Transactional file systems, like that would really help you do this syncing stuff, wouldn't it? I mean, all sorts of, it can touch every part of the system that now has to struggle with a crappy file system. And
correct.
I guess the hardest sell is probably like, you know, data integrity and corruption and stuff like that. But having just come off a couple days ago, I had unrepairable disk errors on one of my disks, and then my Time Machine backup also had unrepairable disk errors, and so I had to like reformat or whatever. The disk hardware is fine. This is SSD and spinning disk. It was just plain old HFS plus corruption. That happens less than it used to, but it still happens, and I bet the Genius Bar sees a lot of that. So there are a lot of things that you can pitch for. This is why we need esoteric file system feature that sounds boring, but this is what it would enable us to do. And all those pitches worked really well to say, hey, if we had arbitrary extensible file system metadata, we can do something called Time Machine. And if we had, you know, the, you know, faked up some hard links, you know, Time Machine could be more efficient in terms of storage. And like all these things that were tacked on to, or even journaling, like, oh, it could be a little bit more stable. It's just that all of them just barely squeaked in by taking the ancient file system that we have and, you know, bolting things to it. And I think now we've bolted everything that can be bolted to it. And like, there are other possibilities.
Oh, I bet you'd be surprised.
Well, I mean, like, they made the run at it with ZFS. Like, that was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Like, someone won that argument temporarily, briefly, and then got derailed by, you know, lawyerly things, right? So it's kind
and
of
then,
a shame.
And then left the company.
Yeah, well, maybe that was the wrong direction. Maybe it's good that maybe we dodged a bullet there, like lawyer stuff aside, right? But it's like that argument having lost and having reset is making things worse for the company. I think there are many obvious things you can do within the existing paradigm of like modern file systems like BTRFS or whatever that would really, really help existing features of OS X and iOS. Forget about even like, you know, future possible features, but there are existing features that are just worse than they have to be in all ways. They use more energy, the less efficient, the less reliable. They could be so much better if you had features that exist in other file systems. And that's why I feel like in that pitch meeting, just year after year, someone is losing that argument because all they can talk about is the technical terms and not like imagine how much better the, you know, Time Machine and backup.
I won't speak to the pitch meetings themselves, but you are absolutely 100% correct that many of all of Apple's products could benefit from a different file system. The catch is I'm not certain that that file system exists outside of Apple right now. So it's not a matter of like pulling in ZFS or BTRFS or anything, NTFS, anything like
it's
that.
It's like if only Apple were a company that had billions of dollars and tons of engineering talent or something. You know?
But Apple's not the company that runs with a deep engineering team. I mean, that's...
I know, but like you know, sometimes you have to take things like... There are so many success stories like this. Did they write their own web rendering engine? No, they managed to take this crazy KHTML thing and turn it into something awesome.
Yeah.
Did they make their own new compiler? They found a guy who was doing a project as part of his PhD or whatever, you know, the LLVM started out as. And, you know, they turned it, you know, like, I don't care, like, how it happens. If it's, like, from outside, from inside, a hybrid, you know, like, there are many different models for successfully doing something like that. The worst thing that can happen, though, is that Apple says, we don't do things like that. That's too big of a problem, or that's too low level of a problem. Like Apple needs to be willing and able to tackle. And that's why like Apple Maps is a good thing, because Apple didn't say, oh, well, we're not a company that does maps. They just went and tried to do it. I mean, maybe they screwed it up a little bit. It was a bad first try, but they have to be a company that's willing to tackle the hard, big problems. Otherwise,
I agree with you, but do you really want Apple to ship a file system that you compare to maps? Probably a bad move.
You know? Maps is not a success.
I take your greater point.
But there are many models for successfully doing this, you know, either completely in-house or completely external brought in or a hybrid model. And a file system, like, in theory, they could have been working on this for 7 years at this point and just have something totally solid, bulletproof, tested. They've been running it internally for years and years, and, like, they don't. But, you know, like, it would be great. Like, in theory... we could be at that point now. It's just that
core storage. I mean,
core storage is awesome. Yeah.
Core storage V2 in Mavericks, you know, don't say anything about it, but hey, you know, by the way, your Fusion drives aren't compatible if you made them in Mavericks because we're totally doing stuff over there. And like,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, that is the Trojan horse possibly for,
I know.
And to be fair, you weren't supposed to be making Fusion drives back in, well, manually making them at least.
Making them back then. I mean, it was just, yeah.
Well, it was in the release notes. They told you, like, if you make a Fusion drive with Mavericks, you won't be able
correct,
to
read yes.
it because we revised core storage. And so, you know,
I actually think this whole conversation points at, like, my whole, like, you know, division of, like, top-down and bottom-up features. I would propose that most of the important stuff that we actually care about in Apple's technologies did start as bottom-up features. And it, like... takes somebody like being the nut who is like, oh, you know, like, and they had a nut who was like, yeah, we should have ZFS like be our file system, and then it like, bottomed up, and then it didn't like make it all the way up, and like, but nobody's gonna be like, you know what, we need to go find like an academic like layout paper that like specifies how we should redo how all of our like UI layout happens. Nobody's going to say that from like the top, right? So that's like stuff that must happen from the bottom. And then like those things have such a huge impact. And I think it kind of speaks, I think, to like how random it is what we will actually end up with as, you know,
Did Ken just do auto layout on his own? I know
it's based on open.
I know that, but I mean, did he just like go away and be like, you know what, I'm going to hack it?
It was a very, very, very small team.
Yeah, and I know iOS. Yeah, I know the iOS guys. Somebody just took it and ran with it.
Yeah, I don't know anything about how it came to be within Apple per se, but I would guess that it was a bottom up. Technology on some level where someone was like, you know, this would be a cool thing if we did this. Like, I don't see somebody like at the top saying one of the things that's constraining our developers is that they have a hard time like specifying their UIs. Maybe I'm wrong, but it strikes me as the kind of thing where it's like, that's a great example actually of a bottom-up technology that completely transforms how all development on the platforms Apple, you know, is interested in will go forward. And something like John's saying, like if there's just somebody there who was like more forceful and more competent at like specifying why this like file system thing maybe could be a good thing,
I agree. I think like a strong advocate for John's position. I mean, whatever. Maybe John wants to intern there in the summer and he can just go to these meetings and yell.
I tried to convince Bertrand that file name extensions weren't a good idea. And I think I eventually just wore him down to the point where he didn't want to talk about it anymore. But I'll call that a victory.
Yeah. I think this could have been one of the first arguments I had with you like 15 years ago. Yeah, you're right. File extensions suck. You should be able to call it anything you want. The truth is we interoperate with a larger world.
My argument to Bertrand was that they had all – this is another type of thing where some crazy person decided that there was an interesting idea. Like whoever came up with UTIs, not urinary tract infections, the other ones. They had a better taxonomy than MIME that was, you know, of their own, like a sort of under their own control to be the canonical representation of file type in the system, and they had extended attributes in which to store that. All they needed to do was a policy decision and just say the official location for file type information is that you query the file and we give you back a UTI. And if there is no UTI extended attribute, which is the first place that we look at the file name extension and do blah, blah, blah. And everything else works the same, and it would just let you...
They didn't have EAs at the time when they made that decision.
Well, no, it was way back. It was way back when. But I'm saying, like they managed to slowly add back all the crap that nobody wanted. And they found themselves arriving at a point where, like, all the pieces were in place. Now, finally, without changing APIs, without changing anything about interoperability, but merely changing policy, it's like a philosophical change. Like everything's physically the same. What's the difference? It's like philosophically speaking, this is the official canonical location and representation of file type information in OS X, and it's better than the other ones because you can have multiple file name extensions that have different UTIs because they have different contexts and all those other stuff. Forget about creator. Forget about it. Just type information.
Yeah, and you need two function calls for that, right? Like, I'm bringing a file into the system, add the EA if it needs it based on the, you know, the file name extension, and I'm exporting one off of the system, automatically add the extension since the EA is going to get stripped.
But you don't even need to add those APIs. Like, that's a complication that you don't even need. You could leave everything exactly the same, just merely having it internally. And basically, what it's protecting you against.
But you can't, because if your file name is like my picture, and then you take my picture and you drag it into mail, and you know, it gets MIME encoded, and it just ends up as being my picture without a .jpg.
Well, I know, but like, see, that's the thing. The API that MIME encodes it has to come up with a MIME type. And how is it going to get the MIME type? It's going to call the API to ask for the type of the file. And if that API returns a UTI, then it defines you know what I mean? Like,
let's not talk about mail, because mail is a disaster anyway. Not mail.app, although that is a disaster, but just email in general sucks, so.
But like that's a more esoteric. Like I said, that was an extinction level event where everybody who cares about that is gone. But that is one of those things. Like, what's going to happen there, I think, is we files will not exist before. Like, there was a brief period where our file name extensions didn't matter when computers weren't interconnected and there was the Mac and all that stuff. And then there was this time we were all interconnected and we got stuck with this dark age technology. And I don't think we're ever going to get rid of it.
This is kind of where I was going with saying that, you know, having a strong advocate for a more advanced file system, maybe that works, but maybe the advocate isn't there because we're in a bit of a flux zone in terms of what it means to be a permanent storage device, right?
I think there was some bad luck there because, like, these bottom-up projects where someone's got an idea, almost any scenario is okay, like, where you have someone's really enthusiastic about it and they kind of do it and they can't convince anybody. Well, all right, you tried. Someone's enthusiastic about it and they make, like, a prototype and it looks pretty cool, but then actually they work on it a little bit longer and they decide, yeah, that's the wrong path, right? The worst thing that can happen is someone's really enthusiastic. They make something. It looks viable. People are excited about it. It gets to the point where Apple puts it on their public website. Hey, Snow Leopard, one of the features is going to be ZFS support. Once it goes, travels all the way up the ladder and appears on Apple.com, and then they go, oh, yeah, actually, no, that is the worst-case scenario because it's like that's the big failure mode.
Well,
like, it's great.
That was a worst-case scenario for reasons. Like, there was
I know, were you there at the time? Because you guys,
I was there at the time, and I was very
am I crazy? Like, yeah, okay. Whoa,
there's lawyerly things. Like, you never know what it's going to be. Like, but again,
there were reasons.
and it may be that, again, it may be that that was actually, like, in hindsight, it's kind of good that those other reasons came to pass, because technically speaking, it wasn't going to be that great anyway. But, like, what you really want to do is have a machine where lots of bottom-up stuff can happen, and some of them die in the vine, and some of them don't work out, and sometimes you have to make three or four different approaches to try to get what you want. But you would hope that by the time they clear all the hurdles and get through to the point where you're telling the public about them, that everyone agrees that this is going to be a good idea, it's viable, and everything's going to go, you know, okay.
Yeah,
and
I do think that
didn't happen with ZFS Plus, and that's a big black eye on that whole thing. So now, for years after, anyone who brings up file system stuff, everyone gives them the stink eye. It was like, didn't we do this already and see how that turned out?
But, I mean, I do think that that's an anomaly. I can't think of another tech that's been, shipped in betas and then pulled before release. Maybe there is one, but certainly nothing as splashy.
There's probably something else I'd have to...
There probably is, but probably not as splashy.
64-bit Carbon.
Ooh!
Ouch, that stings.
Yeah. Too soon? I don't know.
Too soon.
Yeah. We'll have Rich Siegel on one day, and we'll hear all about that. I don't think the problem is per se file systems. The problem is permanent, dependable storage of your document data, right? And that looks different if you're running a server farm. If you're running a server, ZFS, or, you know, if you're at the scale of Google or Facebook, you've got your own crazy file systems and it's totally distributed and fancy, right? If you're on an iOS device, that looks different. If you're on a laptop that doesn't necessarily have permanent connectivity, that looks different still, right? So maybe we're just at a point in time where a file system is not what you want to be talking about, or, like, because there's no silver bullet that covers the dynamic range of what we expect our computing devices.
When
I was sitting down and, like, kind of preparing, brainstorming for the podcast, I figured one of the questions that would come up would be, what did I miss, or what was I looking forward to in future operating systems? Like, where do I want to see things evolve? And a lot of the things that I came up with right off the bat were things that I would now classify as more iCloud or iMessage, like services, things that store my data, make my data pervasively available to everything else around me. Like, I am sick of managing my data and deciding what needs to be on my phone, what needs to be on my laptop, what needs to be on my iMac. And there needs to be something out there that handles that for me. So you're kind of touching on that a little bit. Like, The local file system is always going to be important. Like, there's no way of getting away from having some local cache of data. Like, that's just going to be it a level 5 cache or be it an actual legitimate, like...
But if you look at the way that videos on the iPad works, you can stream anything you want that you've bought from iTunes. But you can hit the little cloud icon and it'll get downloaded locally. And so if you're going on a trip, you can hit the little cloud icon and get your shows queued up, and then you can go watch them on the plane. I think that's one button too many, but I mean,
I agree.
It's still something better in a way, you know, like you,
Like when I'm thinking about the storage hierarchy, I do think a little bit about the BSD core and how focused like the POSIX API is on the concept of files and file based things. And if you if you like envision this, you know, Carmack type world where you have a unified memory model that spans your entire storage hierarchy, and if you then extend it to say, like this is what I was talking about a couple of podcasts back about Apple handing cloud storage. If you extend that sort of virtual address space spanning all storage to say, all right, well, we got this L5 cache that's the local SSD. Why not an L6 cache that's iCloud? Why can't there be a unified storage structure that spans the whole thing? And then your barrier is like, that's great and all if you come up with this amazing thing that spans the whole file system. But our operating system and kernel really thinks in terms of files and paths. And like, we're not running plan 9 here.
You beat me to plan 9.
Right. That's the type of big thinking. And it's like, and then once you go into that big thinking, you're like, oh, but we're so far from that. Screw it. And then you're just back to, let's just stay the way we are. And so I think the only way to get there, kind of like making the iPad Air thinner, like the only way to get to credit card sized devices is you have to do all the devices in between that are incrementally thinner. And that's why I think a step along the way to this utopia is maybe you can do fits and starts and do some leaps. But at a certain point, you're not going to go right from HFS Plus to, you know, storage hierarchy that's magically a cloud and a kernel that magically is more like Plan 9. Yeah. Like, you're not going to make that leap. So,
some 256-bit address space that just...
There are a series of steps in between there, and we need to get to whatever the next one is. And the longer we delay it, the more you're just like... The more it could potentially be a problem down the road. So many things are in Apple's favor that are making it not, but like, you know, the Ed Catmull thing, success hides problems. Lots of Apple success is hiding... this one little kind of problem that isn't probably that big of a problem now, but it kind of is. And again, I always get at like the one other thing that's not in Apple's favor is storage sizes keep increasing. SSDs have saved them. We did a backslide there, kind of like iOS has saved them with Objective-C, whole other conversation. Storage sizes are getting bigger and photos are getting bigger. And like people just have so much personal information that's important and irreplaceable. You know, pictures and videos and stuff. And I think people would take even more videos if everyone had Google Glass or something that's like recording things all the time or whatever. Like, you know, that's irreplaceable personal information. And I don't think it's excessive to say that I would wish somebody would checksumming that at some time. And maybe the cloud's doing that for me and it's checksumming it. But like, if I'm still responsible for backups at all, and if I have any local storage, and if it isn't pervasive cloud backup with unlimited bandwidth everywhere, like, there are steps that we should be taking along that road, and I hope they come sometime in the next 10 years.
I think we all agree on the goals. I just, you know, we all want to cross the creek, and some of us are wondering which rocks are stable and which ones aren't, to be poetical.
Yeah,
very philosophical.
Yeah. HFS Plus is a big spiky landmine floating.
Well, we're standing on it, but, you know.
We're jumping on that.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at John Siracusa's, Legend of Zelda avatar here, and thinking this is the great adventure for HFS to ZFS. As he jumps across these lands,
Zelda file system.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll get ZFS or Riser FS. Well, we're certainly not getting Riser FS.
I'm going to skip those tasteless jokes.
I think BTRFS is licensing compatible. But, you know, core storage is like, that's the dark horse.
We can sneak a
file system in by making manages blocks and allocates them.
My guess would be if anything...
The bottom line is there is no third-party file system out there that meets Apple's needs. That's the very succinct answer to that.
Yeah, I was going to say
a lot of investigation has been done on like the various demands that are placed on things. Even like BTRFS is fantastic, but licensing issues and reasons killed ZFS. That's the best I can say. And
I think if we get anything, it'll be I think if we get anything, it'll be simpler rather than more complex.
Simpler in certain ways, but significantly more complex than others is kind of my. Sure. And this is
the way traditional file systems work are based on spinning disks and allocation tables and like the seek times, and we're gonna if we do see something, I think it'll be based on like here's how SSDs actually work.
Correct. Yes.
Here's what we can do.
That is what I would expect. And again, knowing nothing about what they're working on, like.
Right. Yeah.
I can now divorce myself from having internal knowledge that's where I expect things to go is kind of like what John said earlier. We have NAND, like let me address the NAND. I don't need to know sectors and regions and seek times and it's NAND. Just let me address the memory. Yeah. And that simplifies a huge number of things and introduces other opportunities that can be played upon.
For, and especially in Apple's
file systems and backups and other things that would be desirable.
Yeah. Well, like 4K
Apple, Apple has the ability to cooperate with whoever's supplying their NAND and the controllers on it, because the firmware on the NAND has been taking over more and more of the heavy lifting of making storage, the storage system work. And Apple is uniquely positioned to work with a vendor to, because like they don't expect you, oh, you can just swap in a different SSD. Like the number of machines you can continue to do that on is like continues to shrink, right?
And is that so, even possible today?
The Mac Pro, I guess. I mean,
oh, the Mac, yeah, the Mac
like,
Pro. I was gonna say,
or like, even on the MacBook Airs, like Otherworld Computing makes these little things you can swap in. But like if anyone could get away with working with a NAND vendor to go hand in hand with whatever the, you know, core storage V7 that works, you know, directly addresses the NAND and cooperates with the firmware that's on it, because there's, you know, a lot of the traditional file system stuff of allocating things or whatever happens in the NAND controller, you know, in the SSD controller, and then there's also a component in the kernel, and if they could work together, like this is the type of thing that, you know, only Apple could do, and they could say it up on a big, you know, on their slide, that their opportunity is there for the taking. And I guess I would continue to hope that like core storage is like that's their long term plan, and like beginning they're just doing these little things. But you know.
Yeah, even looking beyond just the local system, so you have the firmware on the controller, you have the kernel that's actually communicating with that, then you have all the daemons that sit on top of that, like Time Machine and the various iCloud sync daemons. They can all work in concert to get data to and from that very local storage up into the cloud, and do so in a much more resilient and efficient manner than what we're doing right now.
Yeah,
and the other thing is it's transactional. Not, like they don't have to take
exactly, yeah,
because you know it's GPL or whatever and license problems. But like the ideas embodied by BTRFS or any other transactional log structure system, like let's take those good ideas and incorporate them so we can get features X, Y, and Z. And
my holy grail would be having transactions happening locally on my machine that get shoved up to a time capsule that's sitting somewhere in my apartment. And over a period of time, those transactions then propagate up to the cloud. And at any point in time, I can browse back and forth in that same Time Machine UI I have, just instead of browsing through the abstract Time Machine snapshots, it's instead browsing through the file system snapshots that have been made. And I can say, oh yeah, I totally want these set of files and pull those over. And the same logic is able to propagate backwards and forwards.
We have to send the diffs. You don't have a giant directory full of files representing hard links.
Exactly.
As many great things that there are about ZFS, you know, volume management, all of this kind of, you know, there's a lot of good stuff about it. I think ultimately it's the transaction model that unlocks a lot of the potential of, you know, the future file systems and in terms of sharing it across the, you know, to iCloud and all that. And when it comes to writing the firmware for SSDs, it's not unprecedented, because if you look at the way that Apple handles OpenGL as opposed to Microsoft and a bunch of other people, Apple writes like 98% of the actual drivers for the cards, and it's only like very low level stuff that the vendors actually do, which is why OpenGL is consistent across Macs in terms of behavior. Like Apple adds all of its own extensions, it does a lot of the OpenCL work. The card manufacturers really just get down to like, okay, when you want this, I've got to mess with these bits on this particular address line.
Well, so the core getting back to the core storage thing, doesn't that is my perception naive about core storage to think that it's such like a low level like intervention between me and like my app and the file system that really Apple has a lot of flexibility to do whatever they want intervention level? Like it seems to me like, you know, the main reason I use core storage, or that I know that I'm using core storage, is because I'm using the secure file vault, the encryption.
Encryption.
I see core storage as sort of like a microkernel that's sitting below a more traditional file system kind of thing.
I mean, that's why I call it the Trojan horse. Like it is.
Yeah,
it's something that can be deployed gradually and evolve gradually. And at some point, again, I must make it very clear, I have no internal knowledge about what might be going on. But at some point, it could get to the point where it is able to gracefully migrate between HFS and some future file system, or become the future file system. Like it can subsume what is on disk right now and still present like an HFS layer above for things that need it, but handle storage management on the disk in a very different way, and then move that away from being HFS only to anything else that it wants.
Because if you look at what a core storage does, it does almost the same set of things that a file system does in terms of I have a bunch of data, I have to keep track of where it's stored, I have to lay it out in blocks and allocate it, and do, like it does things that file systems do. It just doesn't do a couple of different ones. And any future thing is going to have to preserve like all the crazy HFS driver stuff. I mean, if you just look in the existing HFS driver, I mentioned this in my Mavericks review, like seeing like, well, when you access this extended attribute, there's a clause in the code that says, if the extended attribute name is this, do this crazy thing. And like, Apple is willing to do that to preserve backer compatibility with whatever crazy thing. So it's like, yeah, you could yank that stuff out and applications wouldn't be any the wiser because they call the same APIs. It just wanders down a different code path. Everything looks the same, but all of a sudden HFS Plus is no longer between you and core storage. And you don't know it because all your APIs are the same. Like, and then, you know, how they brand that or what they do it or what other features are exposed or whatever. Like there's inevitably going to be some ugly, gross transition in there for the poor suckers who have to program this, but hopefully for the users, it won't be all that bad.
Well, certainly you can imagine the NS workspace and all of the foundation layer stuff migrating. It's, you know, the POSIX stuff, maybe there's some weirdness there.
File copy APIs where it's like, you know, every year they're like, here's the new file copy API. This one really preserves everything. No, seriously.
Right. Yeah. No longer can you just open the file handle and you have to write out a bunch of bytes.
The file system is not a serious transition for the developer. Like there will absolutely be things that would need to change in certain applications to preserve compatibility or improve fidelity or things like that. The biggest challenge is with users. So I have a school lab situation. I have a student who walks up and they give me an SD card that is formatted HFS. And I plug it into the machines that are running whatever new version is running, expecting core storage. What happens with that SD card? It probably stays HFS Plus. But if I reformat it, store new data on there, hand it back to the student, what happens there? Like, does it stay HFS Plus? Like, do we continue persisting HFS in these ways?
They already do that for Microsoft. They already do that for FAT32 and whatever in TFS, right?
Yeah, but that's crazy old school shit. You don't want to be doing that.
You ever see the BTRFS demo where they take a disk that's not formatted in BTRFS and they like quote unquote reformat it as BTRFS, but it doesn't actually change the blocks on disk? And then since BTRFS is like append only, it just starts appending the changes. And you can revert it back to the old version.
Oh, that's actually fascinating.
Yeah, like there was in that demo where they're like, oh, well, you know, because like the particular properties of sort of a log structure depend only file system is like, we can give you back your old disk because, in fact, we never got rid of it. And the blocks were always there and we just merely mapped them into our structure. Like
that is fascinating. I'm going to have to watch the demo. That's fucking brilliant.
I may be misremembering the details, but it was along those lines of taking advantage of one of the properties of this particular file set. And, you know,
the
transitions are always super, super painful. Like,
well,
you know,
but I raise this because file system transitions in particular are perhaps the most painful transitions that can happen.
Yeah.
Because at some point you do have to deprecate the old file system.
But do you have to do it on the same disks? Like my approach would be like, you know what? We've got a new file system. You don't get to format a disk that's been previously formatted. If you want to format it, we're going to nuke everything on it.
And that's totally fine. But what it comes down, okay, so developers are a great use case for at least this.
I wouldn't even put it in the tools that the user can use. It's like,
well, maybe you can do it on iOS first, because that's like maybe like whatever your fancy new thing. Do it on iOS first.
iOS and the built-in drive from the Mac.
Hell, you want on iOS? Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I was going to raise is developers are perhaps the greatest use case for this, or even Apple's internal engineers, where you install a new operating system 10.10 whatever, and it, because it wants to be the most advanced file or the most advanced OS it can be, it reformats your file system and maybe it does in a way that like BTRFS, like it just keeps all the blocks on the disk the same, but layers data structures on top that make it more advanced. And you're up and running in the new thing. Well, okay, so it has done this transition. Now what happens when you boot back into 10.8, 10.9, 10.10 because you need to fix a bug and you need to get data from your old system? what does the disk look like? And how do you get at the data that's on your new 1010 system when you're in 1008, 1009, 1006, whatever?
Me? You don't get to see the disk.
HFS wrapper for HFS Plus. You remember that?
Absolutely.
Silly thing?
But those are the kinds of transitions developers would be incredibly angry about. And I hope Apple makes it. I totally hope that doesn't hold them back.
Yes.
But that is the kind of thing that they need to be aware of and that they are thinking about when it comes to a file systems transition, because that's the user's data. Like, you ruin that in a way, or even if you change that in a way that they think it's ruined, they're going to be up in arms. They're going to be angry. That's AppleCare. That's huge expenses to the company.
So I agree. I think we have an advantage now that we didn't have when Apple went from HFS to HFS Plus, and John just mentioned that they had a nice wrapper so that you'd get, I believe it's a text file, right, John? Like, it would open up and say,
yeah, where did my files go or something? It was like a tiny wrapper with a little teach text file or whatever.
Yeah, and that's cool. The truth of the matter is we no longer have a lot of drives that, you know, we don't have floppy drives anymore. Sneakernet is dead. Yep. We've got
USB sticks
keys,
are running fat. Right?
FAT32, right? Like, you know, that's, it basically should be legal to format in anything but FAT32. although it's a crappy file system, but let's just agree to use it at this point.
Well, it's EXFAT. You know, so, it's the new.
EXFAT, yes. It's EXFAT. Because you've got much larger file systems than what FAT32 can handle.
Yeah, right. So whatever. Let's just leave that bullshit to Microsoft. That's fine. They're, like, USB sticks are, you know, they're the zip drives of the world, right? Like, give them another 10 years and they'll hopefully not really be there anymore. But so there is the advantage now that hard drives are effectively a fixed component of the devices these days, or at least they will be in the, you know, 3, 4, 5 years.
They are.
Know?
I mean, for all the machines that Apple sells today, they're a fixed component.
Right. So this issue of updating a drive from one file system to another is maybe not so pertinent anymore. Like, if you buy a new machine, it's in the new file system. If you upgrade one, it's in the old one, and it uses the old drivers to read it. You know, what are they called? The kernel extension that is specifically applicable to the
The file system extensions. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So maybe it is. Maybe we're in a sweet spot. Certainly on iOS, we're in a sweet spot because what the hell?
Oh, iOS. Yeah. Do whatever the hell you want. Absolutely. Like, that needs to be a transition that happens sooner rather than later. But when it comes to OS X, I think making Mavericks free was honestly like one of those laying one more stepstone down the path to getting to the point where we just don't need to care about all these delicate file system upgrade scenarios, because the future is going to be, hopefully, almost everyone can install Mavericks and get whatever is new for free. Mm-hmm. So thus, you're not having to go out and buy, I have two machines at home. That means I can't get a single user license. I have to go out and buy the five-user family pack. Or I am at a lab scenario, an office scenario, something like that. I have to make sure that the entire building gets upgraded, right. The division gets upgraded, the lab gets upgraded. No, it's a free upgrade. So we'll make sure it all happens at the same time. And it's not going to cost anyone anything aside from the time needed to make that happen.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, as a developer, the fact that Mavericks is free is a killer feature. It's the killer feature. It's like
that is huge. That's enormous. That's something that cannot be ignored. That allows everyone, many people, the vast majority of the Mac population, to move to the most recent technology that is out there.
Yeah. So,
and
John,
if they do that for the future file system or for whatever operating system introduces the future file system, that obviates a huge number of concerns about compatibility. Because before, it would be the case like, oh, we've got these series of lab machines that we can't afford to upgrade. We're a school district. These schools have these schools have that. So we can't do it. And that makes transferring data between these machines, if the teachers aren't careful, very tricky. And instead, okay, no, it's free. Upgrade everything all at once, all to the same system, and
it's an accelerator.
We're good to go.
This has to turn into an actual show that people will listen to at some point. But you think? I don't know. Could we split this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it has to be split.
Yeah, I think so.
Really, everybody? Okay.
No idea where you'll split it. That's up to you.
Yeah,
it's totally untenable. It might even be a threefer.